Good morning.
Good morning.
Sound is working. Today the topic is continuous authentication. That's not the correct. Yeah, okay. The title, I'll change the title. Title is obviously not correct. It's continuous authentication. Today. I will give a background on the topic before I'll describe a full continuous authentication system. I'll focus on performance reporting because that will be different from what you have seen so far. We'll extend the continuous authentication system to include more information to be able to reach better performance. Then I'll go over to some other modalities. For the main part, I will focus on keystroke dynamics on a computer. Yeah, but all the IDs can be ported. But I'll go into some other modalities that where continuous authentication is also possible. And there you see that there are slight differences there. And then I'll go into something which is called continuous identification. So that's a new concept that it's an exciting concept. Let's first start with the background. So we have a computer. And we need to protect it. We need to protect it against other people. And in principle, there are two ways that people can get access to my computer. There's the physical, the network side, and there's the physical side. So if you want access to the information on my computer, either you go through the network, electronically, so to say, or you come here and you operate with the device. Yeah, and from the network side, we have virus scanners, we have firewalls, we have intrusion detection systems. So we have good protection in place already. It's an old picture. We don't use telephone lines anymore. From the physical side, we have access control. We have username, password, we have tokens, biometrics if you want. And so in principle, my computer is protected. From the network side, I make sure that the information coming in and going out is okay. From the physical side, I make sure that the only person who can get access is the one who has the password or who has the biometric feature. Yeah, so all is okay. Except that there might be something like session hijacking. My computer is unlocked now. If I would go, then there is no more access control. The computer is open. It's available. So access control, in the beginning, is just checking the identity at that point in time and not afterwards. So we discussed this before already. There are different types of authentication. One is to get access and one is to reconfirm the identity of a user. So the first one is at the start of the session. That's your username, password, or your fingerprint or your face recognition. And to reconfirm the identity is during a session. All the actions that are going on the computer, those will be used. To get access is to make sure that only a genuine person can unlock a computer, can get access to that. While reconfirming the identity is to protect against session hijacking. The first one is to give access. The second one is to take it away. Case something is going on. Different forms are possible. We discussed that when we talked about keystroke dynamics. So you have the static, where all the information is the same every time that you log on, or more or less the same. But you had also challenge-based. You had all where you can imagine that you get a one-time password to your phone, serving as a token that you have to type. Could be free. Completely free. So there are different forms possible. We refer to this in general as static authentication, just to have a name. And it's a 0-1 decision. You get access or not. In when we talk about reconfirmation of the identity, there were two major forms, periodic authentication and continuous authentication. Continuous authentication, monitoring all of the time, everything that is happening is monitored and a decision can be made at any point in time. Periodic authentication is every so many minutes, every so many actions, every so many whatever, the past period is evaluated, and based on that, a decision is made. So there are discrete decision points. Let's look at biological versus behavioral biometrics. So in biological biometrics, they are relatively easy to measure at discrete times. A fingerprint, I have to put my finger on a scanner. Iris recognition, I have to show my eye to a scanner again. Face recognition, you could do, or maybe voice recognition, you could do a bit more continuous, but yeah. Behavioral biometrics in general can be measured more continuously. Voice recognition, whenever I talk, I can measure it. Keystroke dynamics, whenever I type, I can measure it. Special sensors are often needed in biological biometrics. Again, not all of the time. Yeah, the camera, the webcam is there, so I can do face recognition relatively easy. But for fingerprint, for iris, you need often specialized equipment. Behavioral biometrics, the sensors are present often. The keyboard is there, the mouse is there, I can measure that right away. Again, biological biometrics often starting with an image, so you need image processing, some kind of heavy computation, while behavioral biometrics is a bunch of numbers often, which is relatively easy to process. Biological biometrics can be seen as intrusive. Certainly if we talk about a webcam that is continuously taking pictures of you, that's intrusive. If you have to put your fingerprint on a scanner every time, that's considered intrusive. Behavioral biometrics can also be considered intrusive. Yeah, but often you can provide biometric information while doing your daily business. Yeah, but maybe the fact that I monitor your keyboard to determine how you're typing, yeah, that could be sensed as intrusive also. Biological biometrics is often best suited for getting access, while behavioral biometrics is generally suited for continuous authentication. But that's not like carved in stone. Yeah, so there can be some variation to that. Then when we look at continuous authentication, there were the two forms, periodic and continuous. Yeah, what is the difference there? In the first case, periodic, they use a block of actions or over time, a fixed number of actions or a fixed period of time before making a decision, while in continuous authentication, I can determine what to do at every point in time. That's the idea. When I look at a block of information in periodic authentication, often there is just one block that is processed. If I can continue, I look at the other block with forgetting about what I had before. Yeah, so that process is relatively independent from each other. There is not a link. In continuous authentication, you will see that actually we'll use the current action that somebody is performing, but we'll keep in mind the history of that person also. So it's not that it's just one action that leads to a conclusion. In literature, you'll see that periodic authentication is not used a lot. It's always called continuous authentication. And then a major difference also is that when I look at a block of actions, I can make a decision on that block of actions. I can still talk about false match and false non-match rate. That block of actions was from user I, but the reference was from user J, and so we could have, and if that block is accepted, that would be a false match. Yeah, or the other way around, false non-match you can also define. So you can measure performance anyway in false match, false non-match rate. Well, that is no longer possible for continuous authentication, and we'll see how to do that anyway. So what's the basis, what's the general idea behind continuous authentication? The idea is that I, in general, will behave like myself. Most of the time, I behave like myself. Sometimes, my behavior deviates. Yeah, when I'm working behind my computer all day long and I'm typing on the keyboard, 9 out of 10 times, I will type in the way that I always type. 1 out of 10 times, there might be some slight deviation from that. Either just because I'm not a robot, I can't do everything exactly the same every time. Yeah, so there is natural variation. Or maybe I'm angry, or maybe I'm stressed or something. There are external factors that influence my behavior. Yeah, but generally speaking, I do a lot of times what I am normally doing, but sometimes there is smaller or larger deviations from that. So that's great. But on the other hand, sometimes you will behave like me. There will be an overlap between one person's behavior and the next person's behavior. So sometimes somebody else might behave like me, but most of the time, most of the things that he does are different. Now, talking about keystrokes, some of the keys you will type in the same way as me, but most of the keys you'll type in a different way. So that's the fact that we'll try to use. Sometimes I don't behave like myself. I don't behave normal, in my normal fashion. So you could say that I do something wrong. I make an error. That doesn't mean that I'm an imposter. Right? So if I'm monitoring all my keystrokes and once in a while there is one that is the dynamics is different from what I'm expecting, what's defined in the reference, yeah, that doesn't mean that I'm a bad guy. If I make relatively many mistakes, yeah, then that's a good indication that it could be somebody else. So if we look at that, yeah, we know that we make mistakes. There is in behavioral biometrics in general, there is a large intra-person variation. So what do we do if we want continuous authentication? Should we log out a person when he makes a mistake? Obviously not. Should we allow maybe more mistakes? Depends on how much I do. At some point, I will make 100 mistakes during the day. Yeah, if I make a mistake one every 10 keystrokes, then it's 1,000. If I make one every 100 keystrokes, which is very low, which I can't get. But if I make a mistake once every 50 keystrokes, that's 5,000 keystrokes, and I have my 100 mistakes already. Probably much, much earlier. Maybe I should look at the ratio. How often, on average, do I make a mistake? Out of once in every 50 keystrokes, once every 20 keystrokes, 7 out of 10 keystrokes. Okay, that last one could be an indication that it is a different person. So that could be something. What we always also have to consider is that not all things that I do wrong are equally wrong. Yeah, the decision to say I did it according to my profile or not, according to my reference or not, that's in principle a binary decision. So there is some kind of threshold that says, okay, now your behavior was within the threshold or outside the threshold. But I can be very close to that threshold when I'm doing something wrong. Or I can be far away. Also, some of the keys, I'm quite stable in my behavior in typing. Yeah, so when I make a mistake there, yeah, that might be more severe than when I look at the dollar sign or the pound sign. I hardly ever type them. So if I type them out of the ordinary, whatever ordinary might be there, yeah, that's not a big deal. So not all errors should count equally. So let's look at a general description of a continuous authentication system. So here we have the system. There's the user. The user wants to start using the computer, so he needs to
to use a static authentication mechanism to get access to that. Once he has done that, he can start using the keyword in this particular case, and will extract features from that, and then that is analyzed, etc., etc. And then at some point, there is a decision: do I still believe that this is the same user or not? If I still believe that this is the same user, I can continue walking, and this cycle continues. At some point, the system, if this is an imposter, at some point the system might make a decision: this is not normal behavior for the genuine user, and it will lock him out, and then the user has to try to get access again with static authentication.
So that's just using using keystroke dynamics. In principle, I could also monitor
the behavior of the mouse. And same thing, I'm using the computer. At some point, I start typing on the keyboard, so I'm taking this part of the cycle, and then I start moving the mouse. I'm going this way around. Yeah, there are very few times that you actually use mouse and keyboard at the same time, but even there, you can find a solution to this. Yeah. So in this case, both the way that I type on the keyboard will influence the decision, and the way that I use the mouse will influence the decision. But at some point, I make a decision: do I still believe that this is the correct user or not? Is the current user the genuine user or not? If so, continue. If not, lock the system and use static authentication to get access again.
So the basic concept that was developed is a concept of trust.
The trust in the genuineness of the user, of the current user.
So this CEA system is running in the background, is monitoring the way that I use my keyboard, or the way that I use my keyboard and the mouse, or the way that I behave behind the computer, and it has some kind of trust that, yes, this is still Patrick. This is still the correct person using the computer.
But everything that I'll do will influence that level of trust.
Every action that I take will have an influence on the trust level. So if I do something as I normally would do it, this system knows how I perform. This has a profile of my behavior.
And if I do something which will be considered normal,
the way that I always do it, I type the letter E, and the duration was exactly as, or exactly, but it's within the boundaries of what I would expect as normal.
That's perfect. Yeah. That will increase the trust.
Trust was at a specific level, 95%, whatever that means, and now I've done something wrong.
So now the system, something right. So the system says, okay, I believed, I wasn't 100% certain, but I was quite certain that this was a correct person, and he did something even more correct.
He did even more something correct, whatever. Yeah, so I'll increase the trust that I have in him. On the other hand, if I do something out of the ordinary, if my behavior deviates, that's odd. So I'll just decrease the trust. How much? Depends on what I did.
So every action that I do, every time that I type on the keyboard, every time that I move the mouse, whatever I'm monitoring on the system, every action that I do will change the trust, either positive or negative.
And obviously, as long as the trust is high, trust is 95%, yeah, you'll just continue. Trust is 80%, yeah, sure, no problem. But at some point, the trust is just 40%. Or 40, I don't want to put percentage on that, but the trust is 40. And then I say, that's kind of ordinary, out of the ordinary. That's kind of strange.
When the trust is too low, then I will lock the system.
So let's look at how that will work. So we'll look at features, so we're more or less in this part
of the overview. First, yeah, we are typing, we're doing something, and we can extract some features. And we'll focus now a bit more on
keystroke dynamics in general. Obviously, What I'll do on a daily basis differs from day to day. One day I'm making a PowerPoint presentation, the other day I'm writing an article, then I'm programming, then I'm, and that mixes also during the day. It's not that every day I'll start with the same task and the same keystrokes and everything the same. There's a lot of variation. I might use different different amounts of how much I use the keyboard. Now I'm giving a presentation, so once in a while I press the space bar. That's not a lot of activity. When I'm in the office writing an article, I use the keyboard a lot. Different applications that I'm using, different also mixture of mouse and keyboard usage. Yeah, when I'm making a PowerPoint presentation, there is a lot of mouse usage. When I'm writing an article, it's hardly mouse usage. Yeah, you use the keyboard. At least I use the keyboard much more. Yeah, so all of these things differ on a daily and actually also during the day. Same tasks I can actually do in many different ways. If I want to print the document, let's say for me, 9 out of 10 times I press Ctrl-P to print the document. But in principle, I could use Alt-FP. I could click on the print icon. I could click on File and then click on the print option. I could type Alt-F and then use the down arrow to select print, and then when it's highlighted, I click Enter. Probably you can find many more ways of doing that. Yeah? That's my main way of doing that. Other people might prefer that one or another one. Yeah? And I can measure how I do that. Yeah, that could be one of the features that I could consider. How I do a particular task. If we look at purely keystroke dynamics, yeah, we can consider just single keys. I'm typing a bunch of keys every day. I look at every single key that I type, and I look at the duration of that. I could look at what is called bigrams. Yeah, so I look at two keys, and I look at the latency between those keys. Or if I want more information, I could look at the duration of the first key and the duration of the second key and the latency in between. Yeah, how much information do I want to consider? I could look at longer sequences. I could look at trigrams or n-grams in general. I could look at particular complete words. There are some words that I type a lot. If I'm writing email, there is dear such and so. At the end, it's best or regards or thanks, or I publish on keystroke dynamics and on continuous authentication. So these are words that I use a lot. And probably there are words that are common that you also use, and there are words that just I use more than you. There's some dangerous words that we might even consider as, maybe not so much nowadays because we can do all through GUI, but in the old days, format or delete, when somebody was typing that could be considered as a dangerous word. Yeah, so maybe there was a check that this was indeed typed by the correct owner. The features depend heavily on the language that is used. If I look at the bigram AA, yeah, that might occur in Norwegian as a replacement for O. But EE or OO, yeah, that those are combinations that are not seen in Norwegian, CH maybe, yeah, which are common in Dutch, for example. Yeah, so if I look at bigrams, I see a number of features that in Dutch that I don't see in Norwegian. Features can be related, are in fact related to the circumstances. The way that I type in Word, and the way that I type in PowerPoint, or in Skype chat, or in programming in MATLAB, those are all very different. Very different ways of programming. So what application is an important circumstance? What keyboard am I using? In the office, I have the desktop keyboard. At home, this is really on my lap, so I use the laptop keyboard. What day of the time? Day of the time influences the way that I behave. Maybe very early in the morning, I still have to wake up, but now in the morning, say from 8, the clock gone, I'm quite awake, I'm fresh. I'll type fresh. Yeah, I'm typing like I would say normally do. But in the evening, when it's getting 10, 11 o'clock, I might still be working, but I'm tired there. I've been working all day long, I'm tired, so that will influence the way that I behave. Probably more things that you can come up with. So all of these things can influence the features that we can look at. But from the features, we have to create a reference template. So we are not looking at that block anymore. We are looking at this block anymore. Didn't mention that clearly in the beginning, but during the enrollment, I'm still looking at what somebody is doing, and I'm placing that in something to create a template, and then I'm going through the cycle. Actually, that cycle is going back here already. So this is just for the enrollment, and the other parts are just for the authentication. So I have to create a template anyway. The template will be based on if I do an experiment, or if I use this in real life. The template will be made at the beginning. So my behavior at the time when I start using such a system, that is the behavior that is taken. And I can monitor somebody for a day, or a week, or any specific period of time, or an undetermined period of time until I somehow determine that I have enough information to create a good profile. So in the beginning, I have to monitor somebody and then just build a template based on that. In that period anyway, say it's a day, for example. That might be the day that I am creating then I'm writing an article. I'm using Word or LaTeX or whatever a lot. I'm not doing any programming. So then the template might be best fitted for writing and less fitted for my different way of typing when I'm doing programming. And some activity might occur very infrequent during that period. Maybe I'm not using Excel or PowerPoint. Then that information is missing. And then hopefully from my other behavior, it still looks sufficiently enough like what I was doing in the enrollment period. Maybe I'm typing specific keys or not. If I'm doing LaTeX programming, I will be typing the dollar sign a lot in that period. If I'm doing Word writing or programming, I might not see that a lot. So depending on what activity I'm doing, I get more or less specific keys. Combination of keys also. And maybe like the combination AA, I don't see that a lot, or false positive rate if I want to have an abbreviation for that. Maybe in that period I'm using it in an article and it's part of the template. In the end, or maybe I'm not using that and I can't determine how I normally do that, or words like security or whatever. Conclusion is that whatever, I can have a very extensive, very long period for enrollment, and I get more and more and more a good description of what somebody is doing. But that's not practical. At some point you want to use the system. We must then simply assume that the template will not describe everything of my behavior. Things are lacking. Like a key, Z or J, for example. You use them very infrequently. So even if I'm monitoring somebody for a month, I still don't know very well how he will type these keys. So we have to live with a template that is at some level not complete. And we have to use that later on, when we're doing the continuous authentication, we have to somehow,
if I don't know how, on in general, I'll type the C, but during during using the continuous authentication, I'm typing the C somehow, and it's not in the template. Somehow, I have to manage that. So what do I do then?
I said when we're using that, every action will lead to an adjustment of the trust level. And maybe that could be an action that leaves the trust level the same. Maybe it increases, maybe it decreases. We can discuss what we should do then. Template can contain some global and some personal features. Yeah, global features are features that are the same for all users. Personal features are different per user, of course. So global features could be looking at certain letters. I could have added E in that. Maybe space, whatever. It doesn't need to be a letter, could be a number, could be a special character, could be whatever. I could look at certain bigrams that are very common. TH is, I believe, the most common bigram in English. AN, AND, ING, the. Thanks, like complete word. Yeah, so there could be a number of features that will add for all the users. And there can be a number of personal features, of course. Yeah, I'm writing mathematics, I'm writing about prime numbers, PQR used a lot there. Over average, X as a variable, X and Y. Yeah, so because I'm writing specifically on those topics, those could be keys that I use a lot. So yes, they are in my personal profile. Or I'm writing about keystroke dynamics, or keystroke and dynamics and continuous and authentication. Or words that are typed a lot, yeah, we'll put them in the profile. Main thing is that whatever I include in the profile must occur sufficiently often in the enrollment data. Yeah, if I just see one occurrence of keystroke, yeah, I can't derive something general from that. I can't put it in there. Yeah, if I see the X 30, 40, 50 times, yeah, sure, then I can build some statistics around that. When we're doing research on this, there is a pitfall. And the pitfall is that people restrict what is done during enrollment. Okay, during enrollment, I want somebody to type the letter E and the combination TH a lot. So I'll design a text, and I've checked that text that these occurrences of E and TH and IN or whatever occur a lot in these texts. Okay, so please type this text, then I know that I have sufficient data. Right? And then I'm copying a text. But that is a completely different task than what we'll do afterwards. So I have a profile that describes how I copy the text, how my behavior is then, and then I'm starting to use the computer as is, free usage. Yeah, so that's different. So giving a task will lead to some kind of non-natural behavior. So it could be copying from a text or a screen. That is not natural. That's what I don't do on a daily basis. Sometimes I do that. Sure. Yeah, or maybe free copying if you want to look at this. I'm writing an article again. I'm looking at another article and I see some information in there and I extract information from that article and I put it in mine. Maybe not literally. Well, maybe if it's the bibliography, I have to type the title literally. I'm copying. So yes, very infrequently I'll do that. But that's not the general thing that I do. Entering free text based on a given free topic. On a given or free topic. That might be more natural behavior. Please write something about Gjøvik. Yeah, you have to think and you have to act. But still, it's restricting a bit. But this is obviously such a task for enrollment would be much better than this task. Although this restricts again to the application. Yeah, here's Notepad, start typing. So How do I behave then when I'm using MATLAB? Different again. Copying numbers in an Excel sheet. Again, it's a copying task like here before, except then the application is Excel and not Word or Notepad or whatever. That's so we have to be careful when we are creating the reference template that we don't restrict too much. So, okay, we are maybe using the computer freely for a couple of days, and then we'll just look at the data that we collect. We have no idea what it will be. There's no control over that, and then we'll extract features from that. So, for example, the user typed the letter T a number of times, or typed the biogram TH a number of times, and I have collected that all. And then I'm trying to extract information of that. So if I look at the T, I can look at the duration of it. It's a single letter. I don't have much more than the duration. I can look at the average duration, the average way that the user typed it, maybe find the standard deviation. I'll find some statistics on how this user typed the letter T, the duration of the letter T. Yeah? But that is, in principle, the way that he types a T without any context. If I look at, for example, TH, I can look at duration, latency, and duration. So duration of the T, latency between T and H, and the duration of the H. And again, if you type TH, I don't know, 50 times, then I can find some average duration, average latency, and average second duration. Here is also a T, right? So I have now two statistical informations about how he types the T, how the duration of the T is. I have it in general, and I have it very specific here. Those two averages, the average duration here of the T and the average duration here of the T, may not be the same, might not be the same in general. Yeah, because here I have context, and here that's lacking. So if, in the end, when I'm doing the checking, is this a genuine user, what is the trust? And I see somebody typing TH. Yes, sure, for that first T, I can use this duration because I haven't seen that he typed the H yet. Yeah, but maybe this might be a more relevant duration of this T, might be more relevant to use. Yeah, so maybe we have to adjust based on what we now see, based on context that we see. So we have to build, okay, anyway, we have the data that we have for the for creating the template. Yeah. Then we look at all the occurrences of the letter T, and then we build some, we build a model of that. Either it can be a statistical model, just mean and standard deviation, these kinds of things, or we build a machine learning model. If we use statistical model, and then I'll describe how you type. I don't need your data, I just need your data. If we want to build a machine learning model, we want a machine learning algorithm to distinguish between the genuine person and other persons. And so there we have to provide the model is based on the information from the genuine user, but also information from a number of imposter users. So depending if in real life you want to build such a system, you have to consider what kind of analysis will I use? Will I use simple statistical analysis and distance metrics, or will I use machine learning models and everything around that? Yeah, because then that will influence the way that I have to build my reference. One other issue is that, well, the way that I behave today and the way that I behave tomorrow will be more or less the same. But what about the way that I behave in 2 years' time? If I'm not a fluent user, I might get more and more fluent over time. Yeah, that's very... So for young people that's just started using the computer, they are inexperienced, they have to search for the key still, even a normal typing, and not even a random passwords, what we talked about. Yeah, but they will still have to search the keys. We are experienced, we don't look at the keyboard anymore, we just move our fingers around. So over time, we have learned to be fluent in typing, and
mouse usage will have been different also.
So yeah,
even now our behavior might change slightly. So maybe over time we have to adjust our reference.
Comparison. Then we're going over from that module to, well, then I took those two together.
So now our, we have a reference, right? That was made before, and now we are in the using of the CA system. So again, I'm just typing.
I'm just using the computer, and
in this module, the features are extracted. I type T. Features are extracted of the T, or I type TH, and the features are extracted of that, or whatever. Yeah.
And then we have to make to compare that to the reference. Yeah. At the moment,
for simplicity, just
think that we are looking at single keys or bigrams. Yeah, we're not looking at full words. We could do that also, but the description is the same, more or less the same. So assume that
a person types the word them. Yeah, so he types the T and the H and the E and the M.
Very simple.
If he types the T, then I can look at how he typed the T. What was the actual duration of him typing the T?
Yeah, the next key is the H.
Yeah, okay. I can extract also the duration of that particular H. And I can extract actually also the latency between the two keys.
And then it continues with the E and the M.
So exactly the same way. So every time, maybe not in the beginning, but every time I get the features of a particular single key and the features of a bigram, because that's the only thing I'm looking at for the moment.
Yeah, so I'm not getting one.
I'm not just getting the features of one particular action. Like the typing of the E will give me just features of the E. No, there is also context with the past. Yeah, before I type the H, and so there is a relation to that also.
So when I start doing comparison, when the user types a T, I could extract
the duration of how he typed it now, and then I look at the reference, and I can find information about how it should be done.
Same when he types the H.
I know how he just typed it, and I know how it should be done. That's in the reference, and I can calculate again the distance between what I just saw and how it should be done. And same for the bigram in this case. I have information about the bigram. Yeah, maybe I have duration, latency, duration of the bigram.
Yeah, and I have that also for what I just did. I'll make a comparison.
Yeah, so again, I'll get a distance here and a distance there, or maybe three distances here, depending on what I stored.
And for the E, same, I can do that. For the M, maybe, well,
TH is a very common bigram, HE is a very common bigram, EM is not a very common bigram, so maybe there is no information about EM in the template. Yeah. So in this case, I can only calculate distance between how I typed the M and how it was stored in the reference template. But I can't do anything about the EM because it's simply, yeah, the profile wasn't complete, so that's not in the profile.
Yeah, so
sometimes I end up with just one distance value, sometimes I end up with multiple distance values.
How do we calculate the distance value? Anything goes.
In general, because we're not talking about keystroke dynamics,
scaled Manhattan distance gives good performance. Why not use scaled Manhattan distance here?
And as noted,
for a single letter,
the only feature that we can extract is one duration. And so we can compare that to the tablet. We get one distance.
Nothing more, nothing less.
For a bigram, we could, if we store duration, latency, duration, we could, in principle, store or calculate three different distance values.
One for the duration, one for the latency, one for the second duration. But in the end, so we might have one value, we might have three values, we might have four values, we might have a multitude of values. We don't know what we end up with. Not entirely. But in the end,
so this is calculating the distance. Here it says score calculations. So from the distances that we have, we are going to calculate a score. And that score will give me the total overview of a description of, I just did this one action. I just typed the age, for example. Yeah, so I typed the T before, that's already processed. Then I typed the age. I have information about how I typed the age, how I typed TH. Yeah, and I get a lot of distances, but all of that I have to fit into one score, and that one score will be used later on to adjust the trust level. So I have maybe four distances, maybe if I have more features then I have more, but anyway, I have to get that into a single value, and I could just simply say, okay, I have four values, I'll just add them up and divide by four. One way of doing that. I could have some kind of weighted average. One of these three distance values might be is related to this one. This one's more general, right? This was the age without any context, and here it's with context, th. So maybe I forget about this one. If I have a bigram, I'll forget about this one. Or maybe I'll count it lower. Maybe I have three distance values here. Maybe I'll average them first. And then average with this one. So there are different ways possible. But anyway, I'll have to convert a number of distance values into a single score. And that score will then be used to adjust the trust value. So then if we're going to adjust the trust value, we're going from that model to actually those two models. The decision is included in there also. I said before, after every action, we'll adjust the trust level. Yeah, and the adjustment will reflect how well somebody performed an action compared to what the genuine user would do. If it matches very well, how it was just done and how the genuine user will do, the trust will increase, as I said before. We call that a reward. So you've done something well, you get a reward. Thank you very much, well done. But if it matches not very well, so if it deviates from the behavior of the genuine user, we knew that the trust will decrease, we said that before, we call that a penalty. So we're creating some kind of a penalty reward function that takes the score, which we have here, that takes a score and uses that to adjust the trust. On the previous slide, I said you have one or two or three or whatever, you have a number of distances, and based on that you create a score. But what if I just typed the pound sign? Very likely that is not described in my template. So I don't have any distance. I can't calculate any distance because, yes, sure, I just typed it. I have the duration of how I typed the pound sign, but it's not in the reference. So I can't do any comparison there. I can't calculate a distance. And I can't calculate, because I don't have a distance, I can't calculate a score. So what to do then? For the information of what I just did, of that action that I just did, there's no information in the reference of how I normally would do that. So I can't calculate a score. So what do we do? What would you do? Would you just say, okay, we leave the trust as is? Or maybe we increase it, or we decrease it, or we increase it a lot, or decrease it a lot, or small amount. What would you do? What would be a sensible thing to do?
No change, I think.
Well, that could be. Why?
Because if you're going to write something that you usually don't write, like your programming, maybe in a different language or mm-hmm. something like that, and you're doing a lot of mathematics, so you use the star sign for multiplication, and if you get a penalty for each of those characters, mm-hmm. you might be locked out.
Yeah. But the fact that I'm actually doing this task, isn't that odd? Because I had this enrollment period of a day or a week or whatever, and I haven't done it there. So at the very least, it's out of the ordinary that I'm actually doing that particular task. So maybe it's good to have a decrease there.
You couldn't make it perfect that way.
No, yeah, we know that. But hopefully you get it as complete as possible. So if I'm programming, yes, I'm typing star for multiplication. Yeah, maybe that's not in the template, but I'm using X and Y also as variables, or I and J, and yeah, I know how to type them. So it will never be a huge sequence of unknown. Yeah.
Which could you, if you get locked out of your system and you retype the, or you do the static authentication,
yeah.
Could you then have a system that says, okay, if this was you 10 minutes ago, I'll update the template to reflect the actions that you're now doing?
Yeah.
Because you just proved that those actions were done by you?
Yeah. As I said a couple of slides before, the behavior will change over time, and so we'll have, I don't have any more information in the template, but in the presentation, but you need some kind of adaption algorithm. And this could be a very, very good mechanism that, okay, I got locked out. I still assume that we're talking about session hijacking, so not somebody who was able to get my password and gets in that way. So only when I'm gone and this thing is open, then he can attack it. So we need the fact that I just proved that it is me by giving the password. Yeah, okay, then it means that I was locked inadvertently, apparently. And yes, I can use some of the history to update. Or I can ask a user, have you been using the computer for the last 10 minutes? Then I use it for updating. Yeah, because it could be that that you are using my computer, locked out, you run away. I can't know. Apparently the log-on period timed out, and that's why it locked. Yeah, so it shouldn't be automatic. So that updating a template is a very complicated matter, because you have to be certain that it is the same person that you're using data for the updating.
But back to the question, you're saying or suggesting that a small penalty would be the best way to go about
it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'll do a lot of things like me, and some of the things will be not like me. And that last includes also typing things that are not in the template. So either in the category, I'm doing a number of things that deviate from my normal behavior. That is either it is in the template, but I'm doing it in a different way. That could give a larger penalty, or could also include I'm doing things that I haven't done before, so it's not in the template. And I'll give you a small penalty. Yeah, so you can play a bit with it. I think in a particular system we used a penalty of 1 when you were when you did something wrong, and a penalty of 0.1 or 0.05 when you did something that was not in the template. So you can do 20 of those before you have the same penalty of typing something wrong. Yeah. So it should not be at the same magnitude, of course. But yeah, this is anyway up for discussion. If you don't give a penalty, yeah, then maybe I can use it. Or if you even give a reward, then I could try to use it as an attacker. The fact that I know that you're typing something's not that frequent, okay, maybe I can use that in some way to,
as a reward, most certainly.
Yeah.
Exploit that.
Yeah. Okay, let's see about the trust adjustments. So there is a slight difference between statistical and machine learning models. In a statistical model, in principle, yeah, the lower the distance, the better. Yeah, so the lower the score, the better. So if the score is below a threshold, then I get a reward. Trust will go up. If it's too high, trust will go down. I'll get a penalty. And in machine learning, it's different, because in the machine learning, it will give an indication what the probability was that this was from the correct person. Yeah, so there,
the higher the score, the better. So if I have a high score, I get the reward. If I get a low score, I get the penalty.
Talking about penalties and rewards, should that be fixed?
Should there only be two levels? Here I have only two levels. I get a penalty or a reward. Maybe I could have a system where I could get maybe three different things, a penalty, a reward, or no change. You know, I'm in that range what I expect, so let it be. Or if I'm very good, yeah, then you'll get a reward. If I'm very bad, I'll get a penalty. Or I could have, if I look at penalties, I could do something just wrong, because there is a threshold. Let's take this one. If I'm just above the threshold, I'll get a penalty. If I'm way above the threshold, I'll get a penalty. If that is a fixed penalty, it doesn't matter how bad I do. But maybe you could say, okay, yeah, you did it wrong, but just, okay, I'll give you a small penalty, or you did it completely wrong, I'll give you a large penalty.
So in a statistical model, you could use the standard deviation?
Yeah. You could when you're doing scaled Manhattan distance, in principle, you get the distance that you get. Yeah, you have to turn it into a score, but that's if you just look at single keys, for example, you get the distance. The distance that you get is the distance in units of standard deviation. So one standard deviation away, there is I think 66% of all the data should be one. At most one standard deviation away, 95 to, yeah, so then you can base it on that. Yeah, not the absolute, not the normal Manhattan distance, because that doesn't take into account how stable I am on a particular feature. Let me quickly continue so we can have a break in not too long. Trust will go up and down every user action. We had it before. If the trust becomes too low, then the user is locked out. You also mentioned that before. We could, in principle, build a system that gives you permission based on how high the trust is. If the trust is high, over 90, for example, yeah, then you can do whatever you want. But if it's low, below 70, yeah, then I'll lock you out. If it's in between these two ranges, I don't lock you out yet, but I'm going to restrict what you are allowed to do. So banking is no longer allowed, because that could bring harm. Sending email could be something that you also want to log out. But you could still do browsing. You could still type documents or whatever. Yeah, and while doing that, trust could go up and again, and you could get access to a number of these things again. The trust is something that can go up and down, as I said. We limit, and it's ranged between 0 and 100. Yeah, well, we more or less said it looks like percentages, but it's you can't really view it as percentage. But why should we not let the trust go over 100? What would that?
If I use my computer the entire day,
yeah,
and I have a trust level of 10,000,
yeah,
and then I'm away from the computer in UConn, you can keep going for 15, 20 minutes with
it. Oh, even longer. If this would be the logout threshold, yeah, and in this case, I would go down from 70 to 30. In your case, what you said, from 10,000 to 70. So then I have much more time. I'm profiting from the fact that you did well. So that's why we have this upper level. Yeah, very good. Just quickly, some examples. So I use TR for trust, S for score, and T for threshold. So at the start, when I just logged on, I proved my identity. I gave my password. I gave my fingerprint, or whatever. I have full trust in you. Yeah, you can debate if this is a good thing. Maybe we'll start a bit lower to lock out imposters quicker. And I'm doing things right anyway, so I will go up to 100 soon. So if I don't know what it will be if I would start at trust level 90 or something. Anyway, if there's a penalty, so if the score is more than the threshold, if I'm looking at a statistical model, then you'll get a penalty. Trust will go down by one, but if you do something right, trust will go up by one. Decrease by one and go up by one. Yeah, with a maximum of 100.
And if I'm performing an action that's not there, I'll give you a small penalty. So I can make 10 of these before I get a same penalty as here. And if you get below 50, yeah, then it's over. Then I'll lock you out. Yeah, and you see here that penalty and reward are both fixed. But I can make them variable also. So here in the second example, I look at the score, and if the score was more than the threshold, then I said you did bad. But if I'm just above the threshold, yeah, I'll get the same penalty than when I'm way above the threshold. So maybe I can look at this difference between the score and the threshold. Yeah, because the score is more than the threshold, this will be positive, and subtracting something else, so it will be a penalty anyway. And so this is a possibility of doing it. And you see that the penalty now is variable, and the reward is still fixed. And maybe I'll cap that at some maximum or something like that. I don't want to, yeah, just by one action, you're locked out right away. That would be odd. I could also have the reward in a similar way. I could make it variable also, or different ways. I could have a sigmoid function. And then based on the score, I could adjust again. Here's another way of making the in this case, the penalty variable. Every time that I do something wrong, I multiply by a value less than 1. And that makes it smaller. So in the beginning, when I'm at full strength, yeah, this will be a penalty of 2 in principle. I'll go from 100 to 98. Once it has decreased for a while already, yeah, doesn't go down that fast anymore. Which one will perform better? I don't know. These are just simple examples anyway. Last few slides before the break. In a static biometric authentication system, we check the probe against the reference, as always. And if the distance is small enough, or if the matching the similarity score is high enough, then we grant somebody access. It's a binary decision. He gets access or not. It's a one-stage decision. Only based on this comparison, we get access or not. Continuous authentication is a two-stage process. So in the first stage, based on the action that I just did, I'll adjust the trust level. And in the second stage, I'll check the trust level and decide if somebody can continue working or not. So now I have two stages. First, I process what the user just did, and I just trust. And then only if the trust is low, too low, then I'll buck them out at the second stage. Let's look at it graphically. So this is for a genuine user, and we'll see that here is 90, is the logout threshold, for example. We see that sometimes the trust drops. What is it, like 94 or something, 93, 94. But then it will go up again. And then you see over time, it will stay high. 500 different actions. I'm not sure if this was keystroke, but you can get a similar thing. But sometimes odd things can happen in data that we have for analysis. So this is from a data set on mouse dynamics, not one that we created ourselves, but one that we that was available and we could get access to this. And this is, I'm not sure what it says here, I think 10 to the power 4. I don't know. Anyway, the user is doing normal activity for a while and then he's staying very high all of the time. And all of a sudden there is a drop, and here it's really dramatic. Here we also kept it at 0. What could have happened here? This is from an experiment. This is not real usage data or whatever. This is an experiment where the data was just collected. That was not a system that would lock anybody out. It's guessing anyway. Yeah, or a different user. Yeah, it's again continuous data, continuous mouse data, and so he was using the computer, and then he said, oh yeah, I need you to use your computer. Can I? Yeah, sure, use it. And then it dropped. That's our assumption, because that's the only Okay, only time when we saw that something like this happens. So when you do an experiment, this was again uncontrolled experiment. Do it on your own computer, do it in your own time. And yeah, it could have been that somebody else was using the computer. But any guess on what exactly happened is as good as the other. Back to our own data, the data that we collected ourselves. This is when we look at an imposter user. Again, we have the logout threshold at 90. We see much more variation, doesn't stay as high as before with the genuine user. And sometimes we drop below the threshold and we start it again, and then drop below the threshold again, et cetera, et cetera. And every time, that would have been a logout. The next will be about system performance reporting, but that will be after the break. Any questions? Okay, then let's have a 15-minute break. Okay. The next will be performance reporting. That will be the last three parts are all relatively short. So the performance reporting is a bit longer, also because it's something that is new. It's not as you have seen with other biometrics. So false match rate, false non-match rate are no longer suitable, I claim, in continuous authentication. Periodic authentication, yes, because false match rate and false match rate have a meaning when you look at the evaluation of a block of information. That block is accepted as being genuine while the user was in a poster, so that would be a false match rate on a false match on that block. For continuous authentication, in principle, it is not important if an imposter gets locked out. Sure, it's important. I have an imposter, he's behind my computer, I want him to be locked out. That's important. But not so much only that aspect. It is much more important when he gets locked out. If that person is sitting for 3 hours behind my computer before he's locked out, or 2 minutes, obviously that second system performs much better. He's locked out anyway, yeah? But in the second instance, he could do much less. So what we actually want to measure the performance on is how few actions can an imposter do before he is detected, and how many actions can a genuine user do before he is wrongfully locked out. So we're now looking at the number of actions that a person can perform. Yeah? Either an imposter or a genuine. And so we came up with Ani and Anga, the average number of imposter actions and the average number of genuine actions. So what would be the goal for Ania and what would be the goal for Anga? In principle, what I want, Ania as low as possible. It will never be 0 or 1 or something like that. I can't lock out an imposter after one action. That's impossible to do. Yeah, so you have to allow some actions before the system can detect that it is an imposter and lock him out. Yeah, and Anga obviously as high as possible, because what that means is how much can I do before the system kicks me out wrongfully. Yeah. Yesterday, when we look at pure keystrokes, yesterday I typed slightly over 20,000 keystrokes on the full day, so actually from 5:45 in the morning until 11:30 at night. So far today I'm at 3,000, and I saw somewhere, I don't find it right now, somewhere it said that earlier this year I had my maximum number of keystrokes on a single day, which was around 40,000. So that's a lot of usage of the computer, 40,000 keystrokes. That's yeah. Generally, you have about 20,000. That's what I generally see in my behavior, the way that I use the computer. Okay, so if we want to be able to express the performance in terms of ANIA and ANGA, then we have to do some performance analysis, of course. So what we do is we collect data of a number of participants, and we collect everything that they do, free usage, of course. And then when we have the data per participant, we're going to split it in two parts again. One part to create the template, one part to do the testing. Yeah, and before I always said we split it in three parts, one part to create the template, one part to do perimeter adjustment, and then one part for testing. But I guess the first two, they fall together. So per participant, from the first part, what we do is we create the template. We'll describe how that person behaves. And maybe we'll use part of that. We had this penalty reward function. That doesn't need to be a global function, same for everybody. We could have a personalized penalty and reward function. If I look at the behavior of a person, I can tailor this function more to this person. I can find the threshold related to that person. If I'm a very stable person and my trust is always very high, I can set the lockout threshold to 95. If my behavior over the day fluctuates more, yeah, then 95 might lock myself out, so maybe 90 or 85 would be a better logout threshold for me. Yeah? So depending on the person, we can set personal thresholds, we can define a personal penalty reward function. We need some data for that also. All of that is in this first part. And then the second part is for testing, and either testing against my own template to know something about the average number of genuine actions I can do before I get logged out, but also testing against your templates to see how many actions I can do before I get logged out against your template. Penalty and reward functions can be personal, can be global, of course. Obviously, when I make it personal, I can get a better performance. If I want to have a good performance with different people, I would say you have to tailor it to the worst candidate. That's somebody with a lot of fluctuations. As I said before, the one with a threshold of 85. But that would be not suitable for me if I'm very stable. Yeah, because then it would allow another person, it wouldn't kick me out, because I'm high anyway. I stay above 95, so certainly above 85, trust level. Yeah, but it would allow an attacker to do more. So personal will give better performance. So for a given user, that will be the genuine user, will check his own test data against his own template, how many actions, hopefully a lot, he can do before he's wrongfully kicked out, and we check the test data of all the other persons against that person's template to see if they are getting locked out, and hopefully fast. So we have, for the genuine data testing and for the imposter data testing, we have two possibilities. For the genuine, obviously it's great if the genuine user is not locked out. Yeah, I can go through all the test data, and always the trust level stays above the logout threshold. That's the good situation, of course. But it can happen that this particular person is locked out. Yeah. Then I can look at imposter. I have to make a few changes to the slides afterwards. Copy and paste, right? If I look at the imposter data, the good situation is if the imposter is locked out. Obviously, that's what we want. I'll change the text in the slide. The imposter should be locked out. That's the good situation. The bad situation if there is an imposter that is not locked out. So actually now I have four situations. The genuine user is not locked out, but all the imposters are locked out also. That's the best, of course. And the genuine user is not locked out, which is great, but some of the imposters are also not locked out. And the other way around, the genuine user, yeah, he is locked out maybe once or maybe more. But all the imposter users are locked out. So yes, it is secure, but it's annoying for the genuine user. And the worst situation is, of course, when the genuine user is locked out once or more, but there are imposters that are not locked out. That's an odd situation, but it occurs. We can report in terms of average number of imposter actions and average number of genuine actions. So these are two numbers. Or we can have a more extended reporting. So that's based on the 28 categories that we have. So you get an overview like this. So the first plus and minus refers to the genuine user. The second plus and minus refers to the imposter user. So all genuine stay in, and all imposters get locked out. All genuine stay in, but some imposters are not locked out, etc. So in this particular case, we see that there are 53 users. So this is referring to the genuine user. There are 28 genuine users in this category. There are 12 genuine users in this category, etc. So we'll add up, we get 53 genuine users. And per genuine user, all the other users are imposter users. So per genuine user, I have 52 imposter users. So altogether, I get 53 times 52 comparisons of a template against an imposter test data. In these cases,
these two, the genuine user was not locked out. But we did not put here anything in. We could not measure it in principle. We assume that it is infinity, if you want. Yeah, if he's not locked out in this period, we'll assume that it will continue that way. You're not sure, of course. In these two cases, the genuine user is locked out, so I can measure how much he can do. Yeah, and you get around 38,000, 3,800 action, and then they get locked out. In this particular case, all the imposter users got locked out, and on average after 381 keystrokes. And here in this case, all of them get locked out also after 383. In these two cases, not all the imposters got locked out. In this particular case, of these 12 genuine users, there were 12 times 52 imposter users, and of these 12 times 52, there were 28 that were not locked out. All the others were locked out, and all the others were locked out on average after almost 1,100 keystrokes. And of these, of these two users, each of the user has 52 imposter test data that we are testing it against. So 104 test data. Of these 104, there are 5 that are not detected by the system. All 99 others are detected, but on average only after 1,282 keystrokes. Now, how do we get to the summary?
Well, I'll show you for this.
14 genuine users never got logged out. That is these two categories in total. 11 got logged out after on general data. And so that's what we had already.
Then, in this particular data set, we had so many keystroke dynamics actions on average per user as testing data.
So actually what we did here is put that number in here. We didn't write it down, but put it in here. Yeah, so we have 28 users who have that many actions, 12 users who also have that many actions on everything on average, of course. 11 users who can do that much on average, 2 users who can do that much on average, and then if we do the averaging of that, so 40 that's together times the maximum amount plus 11 times this average plus 2 times that average, and then divide by the number of users, you get not exactly but almost that number.
So I'm not sure where the difference comes from, but that's the way to calculate.
There are 33 users that are imposter users that are not detected, some of those too, out of this amount. That is about 1.2%.
So about slightly over 1% of the imposters will not be detected by this system, unfortunately. In this particular setting, I don't know the setting, but in this, the results that we are giving here is a particular setting of a penalty reward function of whatever. Yeah. But how do we get these numbers?
Yeah, I can calculate these numbers when I have this table filled in. But how do I get to this number?
That's what we measure actually in the analysis. So here we have a particular user, and we want to calculate the average number of imposter actions of that user.
And if I look at that user, okay, he was using the system, and then after a number of actions, N1 in this case, I'll define that as N1, he was locked out. So that's my first indication for the average number of actions, imposter actions that this user could do. But for testing purposes, what we did is, okay, we said, okay, normally he couldn't do this at all, right? If he was really sitting behind my computer, he was locked out, and yeah, game over for him. But in the analysis, what we said, okay, we have still data, we want to analyze more data, so we'll just do as all the data that we haven't used, we'll just start over again with that. So once they drop under the threshold level, the logout threshold, we reset the trust level to 100 and say, okay, you're in again. You start over again. And then he got logged out after N2 actions. And in this case, it was a bit larger. And again, he was logged out. We still have data of this person. We'll bump him up to trust level 100 again, and we'll continue the testing. And then after add three actions, and then you see that twice he's getting locked out very fast. The second time he had some more that he could do. So there is obviously some variation, that's logical. But we calculate the average. And we'll do that. In this case, we assume that the genuine user was user I, and the imposter user is user J. And so we calculate, in this case, that he was locked out after N1 actions first, and then starting again after N2 actions, etc., etc. So he was locked out in this case, we assume, M times. After N1 actions first, and after N2, etc., etc. And then we calculate from that the average number of imposter actions when the genuine user is I and the imposter user is J is, well, I add up all these numbers, divide by M, I'll take the average of that. So just by looking at how often we have to reset the system, start up again, and how many actions they do on average there, that's what we calculate. So this represents a number, the average number of actions an imposter J can do against user I. Because that's a very, if two people are very much alike in their behavior, that will be a higher value. If two people are very different in their behavior, that will be a lower value, of course. So that varies per pair, genuine and imposter user. But for a particular genuine user, he has, in the previous case, he had 52 other users, 52 potential imposter users, and I can calculate that value for all 52, and then I'll average all these values. Yeah, and this will say this is just the average number of imposter actions against user I, and I'll just sum all these values and then divide by n minus 1. Obviously, the last one is the genuine user itself. He's not attacking himself. So that is saying something about how resistant the profile of user I is against an average imposter. And then we can obviously, again, we can do this for all the genuine users, and we can calculate the average over that again. And so this final value is just any imposter, any genuine user, what on average can I expect? So ANIA is an indication of the resistance of the continuous authentication system against an imposter. Very general. Average number of genuine actions is actually the same. I'll do exactly the same as I did before. Hopefully, I see that a genuine user is not logged out. But if he is logged out, I can do exactly the same things. I can measure after how many actions he's logged out for the first time and the second time, and I can calculate an average of that. That's obviously, I don't have an imposter, it's just one user that I have here. So I can calculate the average number of genuine actions for a user I. And then I can directly go over to the average number of genuine actions for the system by averaging over all the users, over all the genuine users. This is an indication of the recognition capabilities of genuine users in the system. So if we can simply, by looking at the data, by doing the analysis, calculating the trust level, knowing what the logout threshold is, we can calculate when somebody is logged out, etc., etc., after how many actions, we can do that analysis. And we can calculate ANIA, ANGA, etc., etc., and we can calculate also looking at the four different categories that they are in, etc. So we can do statistics on that. If we want to report the performance, we can simply give these two final values that we calculated. That's one thing that we can give. Very broad. It's like evaluating a biometric system and just giving the equal error rate value. Just a simple value that doesn't say a lot about a full system. If we want more, we can actually report this on a user basis. But depending on the number of users, that gets a lot of information. This could also be reported again on a genuine versus imposter. So you can give a lot of numbers there. You get more information about the performance of the system. Doesn't get more readable, of course. You can have the table representations to to give a bit more detail specifically on the four categories. There is a connection between Anga and Anya. Same as there is a connection between false match and false non-match rate. We've discussed that before. We'll see that it is exactly the same here. In this case, we say both of them should be as low as possible. A good system has them both very low. Here it's slightly different. We say this value should be high and this value should be low. We'll consider only changing the threshold. So all of the other settings of the system will stay the same. We'll not change any feature selection. We'll not change any distance metric calculation, whatever. Everything stays the same, except that we can play with the threshold. In this case, we know from before, if we play with the threshold, then I can decrease the false match rate, but the false non-match rate will increase, or the other way around. I can't play with the threshold and get both of them down, unfortunately. And I will see that exactly the same happens here. I can play with the threshold, and then maybe the average number of genuine actions will go up, which is great. Yeah, but that has a disadvantage that the average number of imposter actions will also go up. Yeah, for example, if I want... let's look at this. The average number of imposter actions will get lower. How can I do that if I only can play with the threshold? Well, if I increase the threshold, means somebody will get locked out earlier. So then that value will be lower. But that will also mean that genuine users will be locked out earlier. So that value will also get lower. So just playing with the threshold doesn't give me a systematic improvement of a system. If I want a systematically better system, I have to look at other parts. What penalty reward function am I using? What features am I using? How much data am I using for the template? What distance metric am I using? All these kinds of things. So here was the assumption that all was fixed. When we talked about reconfirmation of the identity of a user, there was also periodic authentication. Yeah, performance was measured in false match and false non-match rate because they were working on a block of size m, some fixed size. But we want to compare, in principle, a periodic authentication system and a continuous authentication system. They have the same goal. I want to lock out a system. A user when I don't trust that it is the genuine user. That's the goal. So in principle, I want to compare the performance. Maybe it's better to do a periodic authentication system. Yeah, but to compare the performance, I have to somehow know the performance of the periodic authentication system in terms of Anya and Anga. So how can I do that? Well, the good thing is, we can do it. Obviously, there is a relation between false match rate. False match rate means that somebody is accepted that should not be accepted. We're talking about an imposter. So false match rate is related to Anya. False non-match rate is a genuine user that's kicked out of the system. So that's obviously related to Anya. So let's look at what happens actually in a periodic authentication system. Assume the block size is m, and assume that the false match rate, because we're talking about Anya, false match rate is p, some kind of value there. What happens? Well, I start the system, I do static authentication, I can do m actions, and then I get checked, and I can do m actions, and I get checked, and I can do m actions, and I get checked, until the system at some point decides to lock me out. So the imposter can always do M actions. After M actions, it's the first time that his identity is checked. And there is a false match rate. So there is a probability that the system doesn't recognize him as an imposter. So actually, with a probability P, he's happy and he can do M more actions. Because he just passed one check, start all over again, M more actions.
So he can do m actions. With the probability p, he can do m more actions. With the probability p, after that second check, again, with the probability p, he can do, again, m more actions, etc., etc. Every time with probability p, he is allowed to continue. And if p is small, obviously, then it's not... he can't get very far. What is now the expected number of actions that this person can do? Well, m anyway. And with probability p, he can do m more. And with probability p squared, so I have to pass that test twice, you can do m more, etc., etc. So some kind of infinite summation. Or I can take the m out of it and say it's m times 1 plus p plus, etc., etc. Let's do some mathematics. I'm a mathematician, so this is from the last slide. I'll define this value here, between brackets, I'll define that as s. And then if I look at p times s, well, 1 times p is p, 1 times p, sorry, 1 times p is p times p is p squared, p times p squared is p cubed, etc., etc. So actually I get the same thing. Well, not exactly, there is a difference here. So if I take this minus this, so 1 times s minus p times s, 1 minus p times s, actually I have all of these values minus exactly the same, except that this one value is left. So this minus this is 1. Okay, so 1 minus p times s is equal to 1, or s is equal to 1 divided by 1 minus p. That's a simple mathematics. But s was this part. So actually the ania was m times s. And if I have an expression for s, I can have an expression for ania, m divided by 1 minus p. And p was the false match rate. So if I have the false match rate, and I have the block size, that's important also, then I can calculate what a person can do on average, m divided by 1 minus the false match rate. False non-match rate to Anga, very much a shame. But here, see that here I assume that the false match rate is 1 minus q. So the probability, after the first m actions, the probability that I cannot continue is 1 minus q. So the probability that I can continue is q. And that goes on. Same as before. And now by defining false match rates, false non-match rate, I should do less copy and paste, by the way. By defining the false non-match rate in this slightly different way, not as a probability itself, but 1 minus a probability, I can have the same equation. And from the same equations, I can draw the same conclusion. 1 minus q times s is 1, so s is 1 over 1 minus q. And then Anga was m times that value s, so m divided by 1 minus q, and 1 minus q was the false non-match rate. So now I found ways to express false match rate or false non-match rate into Ani and Anga under the assumption that I know the block size. Unfortunately, in a number of articles, they don't publish the block size. That's too bad. But here is an example here. They did publish it. It's a paper by Ahmed and Traore, and they have also 53 users. That's not the same as before, so this is a different set of users. They had a block size of 500, a false match rate of way less than 1%, and a false non-match rate of 4.82%. And so we can calculate average number of imposter actions as the block size divided by 1 minus the false match rate, slightly over 500, obviously, because somebody can do 500 actions, and then with the overwhelming probability, they are locked out right there and then. So obviously, you can't get much further than 500. So let's say the average number of imposter actions is around 500. Average number of genuine actions is the block size divided by the false non-match rate, which is about 10,000. So this looks reasonable. Although it's a different data set, these were our results on our data set.
Also 53 users. Our ANIA is slightly higher, but our average number of genuine actions is twice as much.
So depending on my own personal working day,
yeah, this would probably mean that I would get logged out each and every day, at least once. Yeah, on the days that I'm not that active, I don't reach my 20,000, so here I would not get logged out on the number of days. On the very active day of 40,000, yes, I would be logged out there.
Was that clear? Yeah, good. Let's, for the last parts, go over to extending the continuous authentication system. So this is what we had before. In our CA approach, we have we lock somebody out based on what he has done in the past, plus, in addition, how we did the last action. So he has some history, he has built up a trust level, and then the last action will change that trust level. And then based on that, I'll make the decision to lock out or not. A periodic authentication system has an advantage over the system that we have. They can have statistical information. Doesn't fit very well in what we had before. Because I just look at one action at a time. I have, aggregated history, and then I have one action. Yeah, but what about the ratio between mouse usage and keyboard usage? What about the frequency of using the backspace? We can't include that here. That is something that I can use here. Okay, we have 500 keystrokes. How often did you use the backspace there? I know that this person, on average, uses it 12 times in these 500. With a particular spread, of course. And they can do that in a PA system, we can't do that. But we could extend our system, of course. We'll start with a normal continuous authentication system, so it behaves as I just described before. It will look at, it has a trust level, it will look at each and every action, it will adjust the trust based on that single action. And then once we decide that we have built up a history where we can look at statistics, then we can start including them also. And so for the first 500 actions, for the first 500 keystrokes, I'll just do everything as I did before. And then once I reach 500, then, oh wait, now I can look at, I've kept that in memory somehow, I kept statistics on that, now I can include statistical information. How often did he use the backspace on these 500? Yeah, and if that is something that I would expect, I can use that again to adjust the trust. Okay, yeah, over the last 500, I also saw that he used the backspace around 12 times. That will increase the trust, or no, he used the backspace 212 times. Obviously, that's out of the ordinary, trust will go down. Again, not so much that it will lock out somebody, or might, of course, but again, the decision is not made based on that single activity, it will be included in the change of the trust value. And so we could start using the system. So a system would look a bit like this. This is more or less the old system that we had. We have the trust model here, we have the feature extraction and comparison, and then the trust is adjusted and based on the fact if it's high enough, we can continue or not, we are somehow here. We have to log in again. Then we could here include a track where also statistical features are kept. And so everything that somebody does is also entered here, and we'll keep track of that. And once we can make sensible decisions on that, because we have a sufficient amount of data, we can include that into the trust model, and the trust is again changed based on the outcome here. We could include template updating here also. And the mechanisms for template updating are not clear at all at this point in time. So we could indeed say, yes, the fact that if I never get logged out,
I don't need to update my template. It's apparently good enough. So it was a very smart idea to think about when somebody gets logged out, to use all data, which I still have, because I have history here, to use that to update the template. Because apparently I did something which the system didn't know yet, and then I can use that information.
There's here something which is called continuous identification.
And that was a new concept that was added a
year or two ago. So I'll talk about that a bit also in a minute. And so we can extend our continuous authentication system. We can
take the best of two worlds, of the continuous and the periodic authentication.
We'll just grab whatever components we feel that give us a better performance. Something about other modalities. So far we have been talking about a computer and a principle related to the keyboard usage and the mouse usage. In the previous graphical representation, there was also SI for software interaction. So I think this was discussed already before. How do you print the document? Control P, Alt F, P, print icon, etc. Same for saving a document. Same for closing a tab in the browser. So there are different ways of doing things in software. This is how I do particular actions. Interesting could also be, what internet browser are you generally using? Okay, I have in this computer, I have Chrome installed, I have Internet Explorer installed, I think Firefox is installed also. Now, I use Chrome, but somebody might come here, open Internet Explorer and start working in that. Oh, that's a deviation from my normal behavior. It's not that it isn't me, because at some point I have these installed because I use them sometimes. Yeah, but it is something which is out of the ordinary, and at the very least the trust should go down a bit based on that. Do I often download or install my own software? Yeah, I do that, you do that. My mother doesn't do that. Yeah. So if all of a sudden on her computer somebody starts downloading software and installing it, well, at the very least that could be a flag that is raised and saying, okay, you're behaving out of the ordinary, I'll decrease the trust. If I'm inserting a USB stick, well, that could be something that is out of the ordinary, because I don't do that, or maybe I can register the MAC address of a USB stick, or whatever, I can register something that identifies a USB stick, and if I see my own USB stick, that's okay. If I see a USB stick of somebody else, a new USB stick could be mine, because I bought a new one or I got a new one, but it could also be from somebody else. Yeah? Yeah, based on that, the trust could go up and down again. That's then not software interaction, that's hardware profiling, but anyway. Yeah. So for a computer, I could have a fusion of all of these modalities. And the model is flexible enough. Model is always, there is an action, I'll calculate the difference, the distance to what I expect, to the reference profile, I'll adjust the trust based on that, and then in the second stage I see if I can continue. And that action doesn't matter if I'm typing something, if I'm clicking with the mouse, or if I use specific software things. Yeah, and maybe indeed include hardware too. Here is a really different modality, gate recognition. We'll talk about that in 2 weeks' time. Gate recognition can, in principle, be done in a number of different ways. But the way that we are interested in is using accelerometers from a mobile phone and letting them measure how somebody walks, and then based on that, make a decision. So in terms of what we talked about, how can continuous authentication be used in such a setting? Well, if I'm using my phone, and at some point the gait recognition module detects that I'm walking in a strange way, but my behavior, my walking behavior, is not as expected, it could be used to lock the system. So this is in principle, again, a way of using identity reconfirmation, CIS identity reconfirmation state. I can use gate, however, also. So this is to take away access. I can, in fact, also use some kind of continuous authentication to give access here. So I have the phone in my pocket. I'm walking around. Whenever I take it out, and I open the sleeve, then I get access right away if my gate was recognized. If not, I have to type my PIN code. I could, in fact, also use it slightly different. I'm walking, my computer is in my office. I'm walking there, my phone is recognizing my walking. Once the computer detects that my phone is close by, via Bluetooth or whatever, it asks, hey, did this person walk in the correct way? Yes, it walked in the correct way, and my computer will open up. That's easy. When I get into my office, my computer will open up. When you get to my office, yeah, it will still be locked, of course. Yeah, if you even steal my phone and you walk there, it will still be locked, hopefully, if the system performs well. When we're talking about mobile devices, we can also look at interaction with the touchscreen. Yeah? In principle, what I do on a computer and what I do with a mobile phone isn't that different in terms of what kind of tasks I perform. I read my email here, I read my email there. Send email, I'll check my Facebook here, I'll check my Facebook there. And so in principle, this is a mini computer, except it doesn't have a keyboard and a mouse. Well, actually, it does have. It has a screen and a swipe on the screen. That could be compared to a mouse move. A tap on the screen could be compared to keystroke typing. Yeah, at the time when I touch the screen and when I leave the screen again. That's the same information as what I have when I'm looking at keystroke dynamics. Timing, unfortunately, might not be as accurate. Of course, it's improving, like all the sensors on a phone are improving. But I do get, doesn't really matter, because I do get additional information. Pressure and area are something that I can measure on a touchscreen that I can't measure on a normal computer. We did some analysis there also on a database, actually two different databases, one of 71 users and one of 51 users, which was a subset of the 71, by the way. A personal threshold or a fixed global threshold of 90, you see that then the performance is slightly worse. The number of imposter actions here is only four swipes, and I detect that it is not you and I'll kick you out. Here it could be 16. More users undetected here compared to the personal threshold. None of the genuine users is locked out because there's nothing here. All 71 are there, but here there are three imposters not detected. Yeah, on the smaller set it was comparable results, let's put it like that. There were more actions. This was a set of 71 with a relatively small amount of data per person, and these were 51 which had a larger amount of data. So that's why there is a slight difference. In principle, we can go much more, much further. So we have our phone there, and that phone should detect if it's me that is handling it. Yeah, we can look at the touchscreen, we just said that before. We can look at the accelerometer for the way of walking, whatever. Most phones now have a gyroscope. I can look at that too. How about microphone and camera? Every mobile phone has that, specifically a microphone. I can take pictures of a person. I can listen to the voice maybe when he's calling or open the microphone at random points in time and listen to the background noise or whatever. I can get data from these sensors, let's put it like that. I can look at GPS signal, I can look at Bluetooth or Wi-Fi signal. I had a meeting on Tuesday in Oslo, a project that is actually looking at data from all of these sensors, except microphone. Microphone was in there. And people from Oslo, when going from home to work, they detected like 2,000 to 3,000 different Wi-Fi signals. Now, obviously, here in Jøvik, will not be that much. But I guess if you would register how many Wi-Fi signals you detect between here and your home, it would be quite an amount, a couple of hundred, probably. We can look at all that data, and all that data, all that sensor data, is something that will define me somehow. We're not sure how to use all that data. The accelerometer data, sure, you can use it for gait. Yeah, but it is registering now while the phone is there and I'm standing here. Yeah, so there is not much acceleration data now for me. And how do we model all of that, of course? That's also an important question. Yeah. The difficulty here is that different people have different behavior, have different circumstances. Yeah, inside the city, as I said, there is a huge number of Bluetooth and Wi-Fi signals. If I'm living in Nulia, so there is a slight decrease. If I'm sitting at home, I see maybe 5-6 signals. Two of them which are my own. So yeah, I don't see that magnitude of Wi-Fi signals. If you are, this is not something just for Norway. This is Telenor. They are also in the Southeast Asia, and so you're a farmer somewhere in Myanmar. You work in the field, you don't see any Wi-Fi signal, yeah, or Bluetooth signal. Yeah, but me, working in an office, my phone is here, it's laying there most part of the day. Okay, when I go, I'll take it and go away. So, but the accelerometer will not register that much amount of data. But that farmer in Myanmar, he's working on the field. He has a phone in his pocket, so he has movement all of the time. So maybe for me, information from these signals could be much more important than from the accelerometer, while for other people it could be turned around. So you have to be very careful on what sensor data you use. It could be something that is very person dependent. What kind of model do we make for a user? One other thing that is important there also, if I'm collecting data from these sensors 24/7, then that will drain the battery. Actually, I must say, the first version of the application that drained the battery within hours, completely from full to completely empty. The current version, apparently, you can go for 2 or 3 days without draining the battery, just the sensor. So it's not using that much. Okay, let's say something about continuous identification as a final step. We talked about continuous authentication. So what's continuous authentication? A continuous authentication system is monitoring my computer to make sure that if you are sitting behind it, it will lock. Right? It will protect my information. That's good. But is that enough? Might not be. When I detect that somebody was using my computer, it locks, that's great. My data will not be cannot be stolen, cannot be deleted or whatever. But it would also be interesting to know who was that. Who was the guy or girl who was actually trying to get access to my information? So that's why we have continuous identification. And obviously we can only do continuous identification. We can only identify imposters that are a part of the system. So yes, suppose that NTNU is going to employ such a system, and all the profiles of all the NTNU employees are known. And then, if Basil would from the next door of office, he would come into my office and would start doing that, he could be identified. Yeah, if students are not into this system, yeah, then if you would be doing this, then obviously, yeah, the system doesn't know you. Obviously, the system cannot identify you. We did testing in two different settings, closed settings. Okay, the system knows everybody. this is a work environment or something like that where all the users are known. That was one setting. The other setting was an open setting. Part of the users are known. So open doesn't mean very open, but we had a setting where we said, well, half of the people are known to the system, the other half is unknown. Yeah. In the first case, I should be able to pinpoint that person. In the second case, I should be either able to pinpoint that person or say, I don't know him. That could be an answer there too. But these two systems work against each other. Why? Why do they work against each other? What do you want for a CA system? Log out and impose as quickly as possible. What do you want for a CI system? Well, the more I know about the imposer, the more possibility I have to identify him. Yeah, so that's the first one. And the second one is very simple. Once I know more about the imposer, I have more data to go on. I'll make more mistakes if I have little data, obviously, than when I have a lot of data. So first test we did on that same data set of 71 people that we had was doing it as a closed user set testing. We see here that we detect the user after 5 interactions with its screen already. So it's slightly different settings than what we saw before. There it was 4. After 5 interactions with the computer, I could... These were swipes, by the way. Horizontal or vertical swipes. Yeah, so you're taking my phone in this case, and you're looking at my pictures, and then after 5 swipes, the system locks. So you can just see a limited amount of photos. In this particular setting, we had a number of different ways of testing the continuous identification system. The best one gave 82%, almost 83%. Probability that we could point at the correct person afterwards. So this is rank 1 identification. If we change the settings slightly, less strict settings, the average number of imposter actions went up to 16. But the probability that we could detect the correct imposter went up to almost 98. That's here. Yeah, so here we had a personal threshold. Here we had the global threshold. And you see here, indeed, the average number of imposter action increases. There are even more imposters that are not detected. But this performance was going up significantly. So obviously, if you would implement such a system, you have to weigh 2 things. If somebody is browsing my photos, yeah, sure, I could maybe give him a few more actions before I lock him out. If somebody is deleting my emails or is deleting my photos, I want to lock somebody out faster. Yeah, so this is in principle a theoretical performance. In a real system, you should check what somebody is doing. What is the harm of the action that somebody is doing? Can I give somebody 11 more actions to do, or should I lock him out? We did it on the computer also, open set. Of our own data set of 53 participants, we took 25. One of them was genuine, and then the other 24 were split into 12 that the system would know and 12 that the system didn't know. The good thing is the system detected all imposters. That's great. One of the genuine users got logged out sometimes.
Sorry? That's a typo. CA system detects all imposters. It should be CA. CI.
No, this one. No, this is still the CA system. CA right. System did not detect this one person. Yeah? Because we're now talking about a open set testing, the 12 people known, 12 people not known,
we have to look at what is the probability that the true identity of somebody is detected. Yeah, that was 18% in this case. The true, correctly detected that this was one of the 12 not known to the system, with 40%. And obviously we make mistakes too. We have somebody who is in the system, but it was identified as, I don't know this person, it's not in the system. And false ID, falsely identified, that were actually two things. Either somebody who wasn't known to the system was assigned an identity of a person in the system, or a person in the system was identified as somebody else in the system. Yeah. But in principle, these two percentages are the correct decisions. These are incorrect decisions, and well, the total is almost 60%. In almost 60% of the cases, there was a correct decision. Obviously, a lot of room for improvement here. That finishes today's presentation on continuous authentication. Any questions? Okay, if not, then we'll just continue at 1:15. Yeah? All right. Thanks.